Good afternoon and welcome to On the Docket. I'm your host, Patricia Salkin, Dean of Touro Law Center in Central Islip. Every Sunday at this time, we talk about current legal issues and how they affect you. Today at On the Docket, we're talking about Brothers of the Blacklist, a social justice documentary that tells the story of the longest litigated civil rights case in American history. September 4th, 1992, an elderly woman in a small town in upstate New York reports an attempted rape by a young black man who cut his hand during the altercation. While looking for suspects, police contact officials at SUNY Oneonta, a nearby college, and a school administrator reacts by handing over a list of names and residences of 125 black male students. For the next several days, those students are tracked down and interrogated by various police departments under a presumption of guilty until proven innocent. In Brothers of the Blacklist, director Sean Gallagher tracks the history of racism and the disturbing events that the college and police department tried sweeping under the rug for many years thereafter. On our show today, we're joined by Scott Fine, the attorney who dedicated 14 years to this civil rights case. Scott serves as co-chair of the Corporate and Public Agency Regulatory Compliance Practice Group at Whiteman, Osterman & Hanna in Albany, where he's been an attorney since 1983. Before joining Whiteman, Osterman & Hanna, he served as assistant counsel to New York Governors Carey and Cuomo, and prior to that, he was a criminal prosecutor. We're glad that you can join us, Scott. Thank you.
Thank you, Dean.
So how did you get involved with this case?
Like so many circumstances we find ourselves in unwittingly. I had spent a number of years in the governor's office, and one of the – we often in the governor's office would look to various groups to give us insights on legal issues, and we looked to the American Civil Liberties Union. We often found their thoughts sophisticated and – and the consequence was when I left the governor's office and entered private practice, they would periodically show up and with a matter, and they just asked for clarification or some liaison to the governor's office. And this was one such matter.
So the case came to you through the American Civil Liberties Union?
The American Civil Liberties Union and the New York Civil Liberties Union.
So what did you think when you were first contacted about the case?
Oh, I think as the kid said, I thought it was a layup. I thought it was just an easy sort of case. Perhaps let me share with you what they told me, and then I think you probably would be able to infer why I reached that conclusion. Your description was right on. After this woman showed up in Oneonta, New York, which was a small community about an hour west of Albany. And she was going to lecture on the Revolutionary War. She was a Revolutionary War historian from another academic institution. She stayed at the Board of Trustees' house. And someone broke in and burglarize the house. She woke up. There was a scuffle. She was cut. The assailant was cut. The perpetrator was cut. And after that, the state police, working with the local police and SUNY police, quite right, obtained a list of students, all black males at the school, and stopped them over the course of several days. But then, after they could not identify the assailant by interviewing and interrogating each of these students, and the interrogation consisted of, what is your alibi? May I see your hands to see if there is a cut? They then closed down the town. The state police concluded that the best approach, and perhaps it was from their perspective, was not to permit African Americans to leave the city of Oneonta unless they subjected themselves to questioning and some inspection, and that included women as well. And so for 4 days, at least three police agencies, and probably only three, drove up and down the streets of Oneonta, randomly stopping African Americans, primarily males, asking them if they could go where they were in a given evening and if they could look at their hands and arms. It became so obvious to people that the African Americans walking down the street, rather than being stopped again and again because there wasn't much interagency communication, would just hold up their hands and rotate their hands around. So if you can imagine a city of minorities holding up their hands and rotating their hands so that the police would not stop them, it's fairly chilling. That went on for about 5 days, and then someone leaked it to the media, and there was an article in the New York Times together with local press, and the African American faculty and students approached the state police and said, "Please don't do this again. This is a small community. Please don't do it again." The state police said, "This is good police work. This is how we deal with."
And this is the 1990s, crimes. Of course.
This is 1992, and quite right. And perhaps then it was. I mean,
this sounds like the 1950s.
It does. It does sound like a sort of post-Civil War. Having said that, one of the interesting aspects of this case is one tried not to get into their heads and decide right and wrong. Right. I mean, as I suggested to the students, if we look for villains, we become victims, and we don't want to become victims. We want to become catalysts of change or for change. So in any event, the state police blew them off. They came to me because I had some relationship with the executive office, the chamber, the governor's office. And I, against the backdrop, to answer your question elliptically, against that backdrop, I said, of course the state police should have a policy. This is simply unconscionable. And so they said, well, would you contact the governor's office and the superintendent of state police? And I said, I'd certainly be happy to do that because it was one telephone call. I didn't know that it would precede a 14-year commitment, and which was my joy. I contacted the governor's office, and the governor Pataki said, I am so sorry. This should never have happened. The state controller said, I am so sorry. The speaker said, I am so sorry. The state police said, this is good police work. And try as I might, and they were civil about it, but try as I might, I could not convince them that race-based policing is probably not, in for purposes of 1990s, good police work.
And did the state police report to the governor?
The state police report to the governor, but the state police, and they're just a remarkable policing entity. Upstate, they have more of a presence, of course, than they do downstate, but they are not your typical police officers. They do not wear badges. They're a paramilitary by design, a paramilitary organization. And you'll notice they don't wear badges, and they wear Praetorian purple stripes and gray. And they play a very big policing role upstate. In fact, but for state police upstate, many of the small municipalities would have to underwrite their own police force. They and so they command a lot of respect and justified respect, but a lot of influence. And so our elected officials said, we have misgivings. The state police said, well, we're sorry you do, but this is how we do business.
So when you went up to Oneonta to meet with the students, so, you know, your contact looking for a policy might have been the Civil Liberties Union, but what were the students saying?
Well, the students could not believe this, and I think this bespeaks a different issue. You have the 1992, and this is a Sunni sort of circumstance. As you may recall, there are 62 separate schools, and we were knitted together in a state university system, teaching colleges, agricultural colleges. Yeah. Everything went fine until the late 1980s, early 1990s, when the schools began to run out of money. They were put on a budgeting system that they eat what they kill. They had to track their own students. And it occurred to a number of these small schools that the best way to attract students was to induce students from New York City, minority students from New York City, replete with subsidies, to come up to these pastoral surroundings in Oneonta, New York. So the students came up, and they were shocked. They were shocked for two. First, the community was moderately hostile because this is a community, a primarily white community, in upstate New York, and suddenly 300 to 500 African Americans parachute in over not many years, and store owners are uncomfortable. So what the students said is, this sort of trigger, this catalyst could make our lives even worse. Our circumstance, we want to go back to New York City. That was the prevailing theme.
So what is it from the lawsuit that you were pursuing? Was it just the policy change, or was there training? Was there sensitivity awareness? Was there any kind of monetary damages that were being sought?
In brief, initially the students, and I don't know many too many folks and faculty members who would ask this, they asked for a policy. Mm-hmm. When the court said you can't have a policy, you can't direct the state police to have a policy, you need something to compensate you. The students said we would like tuition waivers for kids from our community. We don't want anything for ourselves. I mean, really, it was quite. I haven't often encountered that. And finally, the court said, no, you can't have that. You have to come up with some monetary amount. So we made up a small monetary amount to get past the jurisdictional threshold.
Mm. And so were the plaintiffs all 125 students, or was it a representative group of the students?
It was actually, it was 125 students. It was ostensibly a class, and it resulted in two trials.
And were any of the – we'll talk about the trials when we come back, but were any of the administrators part of the lawsuit, or were they – separate, the administrators that worked with the students?
In one case, yes. There was a woman, Cheryl Champion, and this is painful. She was an administrator at the college. She was a recruiter, an associate dean, and she was waiting for a bus during this 5-day period to go down to New York City to recruit students. And as she was online, state police walked up to her and said, "May we see your hands? And where were you?" And she said, "How come?" And she was online with a number of white people, and they said, "Because there's been an attempted rape." And her response was, "But I'm a woman." And they said, "We want to see your hands." And she said, she started to cry, and she said it was humiliating. She got on the bus, and she said from Oneonta to New York City, people were turning around thinking whatever salacious things that think right. people think.
Yeah, awful. Well, thank you, Scott Fine, and please stay with us because coming up, we'll continue our discussion on the documentary Brothers of the Blacklist and the 14-year litigation surrounding this incident at SUNY Oneonta. You're listening to On the Docket with Torah Law Dean Patricia Salkin on Long Island News 103.9. Welcome back to On the Docket. We're joined by Scott Fine, a partner at Whiteman, Osterman & Hanna, and we're talking about the documentary Brothers of the Blacklist, a film based on the true story of racial profiling in a small town in upstate New York. So, Scott, 14 years of litigation making its way through the court system, up and down, state court and federal court. Can you sort of organize for us what was the state court litigation, what was the federal court litigation, and maybe some insights into what happened at the trial?
Happy to. You're quite right. State court and federal court litigation. When it occurred to us that we had to commence litigation because the state police would not move on the issue, we sat and strategized. Sometimes you don't have the luxury of doing that. Here we did. And we decided that we would commence a lawsuit in state court, taking the long view. And basically, we would say that the disclosure of the list violated the Buckley Amendment, which prohibited certain information being dispensed, and violated the Fourth Amendment. What we thought, and indeed it worked out, which was unusual in this business, we said there was an impediment. For 200 years in New York State, there was no such thing as a state constitutional tort. If someone violated your state constitutional rights, you could not ask for compensation. If it were a criminal case, you could ask that the evidence obtained as a result be excluded. But there was no civil counterpart, which means there was no way of enforcing if someone sought to abolish your right of religion, your freedom of speech, there was no compensation. We just thought we would take a shot at getting up to the Court of Appeals. It took a bit longer than we thought. In 2005, I think 2006, we ended up in the Court of Appeals. Appeals. It might have been sooner than that. I'd have to do my homework. But we go up to the Court of Appeals. All the other courts threw us out, and they said, you know, there's no constitutional tort. There's no constitution. I'm sorry, it was 1996. No constitutional tort, which would allow for you to sue Mr. Fine. You're not a very bright lawyer. And
little did they know.
Well, they may or may not have been correct, but in this instance, it was happenstance that it worked out. So, and this is where we sort of wanted them, because I walked into the Court of Appeals, which, as most of you listeners know, is the highest court in New York State, and 7 justices of the court, all learned. And I walked in and I made what I considered to be an awkward argument. And they said, well, Mr. Fine, what is your argument? Why should there be a constitutional tort for compensation? And I said, through the chagrin of my wife, who I should mention is a lawyer and was sitting in the audience, and said, I can't believe you said this. I said, judges, if I walked in here and I tripped on one of your tiles and I fell down and I hurt my knee, I could sue you for compensation. If I walked in here and you abolished my freedom of religion, you're telling me there's no constitutional tort. I can't do anything. And Judge Simons, in his last reported opinion for 32 pages, said, based upon that analogy, although he glorified it a bit, there should be a constitutional tort. And they held for the first time in 200 years that in New York State, if someone encroaches upon your constitutional rights, you should have a right to compensation.
So then you had to go back to the Court of Claims?
Then we went back to the Court of Claims, holding aloft this 32-page decision and saying we are ready to proceed. And several more years pass, and then the Court of Claims said, well, Mr. Fine, that's good. We're glad you've happened on this constitutional tort. But the bad news is we're decertifying your class. Which means, as many know, some may not, when you have a number of people who are involved in an incident and subject to similar facts and similar law governs, they can sue, they can find representatives and sue, and then the award or not would pertain to all. If the court concludes that there's not enough similarity, and here the court said, the judge said, well, there's not enough similarity, they were all stopped for differently. At different times, you have to bring, in our case, 150 trials.
Stop for the same reason.
Right. Those are the arguments I said. I made a keening sound, but it didn't work. So it was a very difficult choice, because when they said that you may not, and frankly, to that point, and I mention this only because it played into our decision, it had cost a bit more than $1 million to prosecute this case. And it was becoming a challenge, and so we decided collectively that we would find two plaintiffs. We would say two plaintiffs. One was Cheryl Champion, one was Ricky Brown. Ricky was the named plaintiff in the lawsuit. Mm-hmm. Cheryl Champion was that administrator I made reference to before. We tried the case. They prevailed.
Mm-hmm. In prevailing, what do you think that the final outcome meant for civil rights in New York?
Well, what is the saying that success has many parents? Well, I think that looking back on it, it was an important case. It was certainly important from the Court of Appeals decision perspective. But beyond that, you now look at the state police and they have a comprehensive profiling policy, anti-profiling policy. New York City happened on it somewhat later. Most small municipalities upstate have such policies. I'd like to think that we were one of many parents. It was circumstances here. And let me move to the federal case, if I may, in just a moment. We also brought a federal action in addition to the state action. And there it was interesting, just almost from a temporal perspective, we said, look, that black is not enough to justify an entire community being stopped. And so it violates the Fourth Amendment and the equal protection under the Fourth Amendment. The court said, and it went all the way just shy of the Supreme Court, and I'll get there in a second, the court said, oh, they said young and black. Young and black meant that it's not just race-based, so you can't make your Fourth Amendment argument. And we had about 10 court appearances in the federal system to that point. And then they said on the Equal Protection Clause, which means can you treat black people differently, you treat white people or Asians differently, you treat other groups, they said The police here said that if the whites were a minority, they would have done the same thing for the whites, and so you have not made out your equal protection case. To which I said, can you point out one instance where they did that? And the state police said, no, there are never any instances where whites are a minority because we're an upstate policing agency. So it turned on itself. But we did seek certiorari to the United States Supreme Court. Certiorari is a request for the United States Supreme Court to entertain the case. And we thought, and others thought, and we had a number of deans from law school working on the application of the Supreme Court, that this would be an opportunity for the United States Supreme Court to say, what role does race play in policing?
Right.
Race-based. And so the court was to hear the application, I believe, on September 16th, 1991, and we were all quite hopeful on, as you know, on 9/11. Race-based profiling became it was no longer an academic issue. It now became national security policy. Approximately a week later, the United States Supreme Court denied the application. So that concluded the federal case.
Could have been different if the case got there 2 years earlier.
It might have been different. One of the nice things about 14 years of something is I went through so many mites and perhaps, but as you and I have talked about many times, I mean, for me, this was, if that matters at all, for me, it was just a life-changing event,
It's sort of the once-in-a-lifetime client, unexpected, coming in from what the case was about, that you'd wind up making new law in New York and changing interpretation and creating a path for recovery.
I think that's right. That's right on the money. I think the other aspect, it would say optical, perceptual change. I grew up on Long Island in a middle-class Jewish home. I was told it was a meritocracy. You work hard, you don't get in trouble, and maybe you can make it. What I found from these students after 14 years and their parents is that that's not true for minorities always. And I would hear these stories, and we would talk about these stories, and they'd say, Scott, you tell us this is our America, but at dusk when we're walking down the street, if there's a white woman or a white man, they cross over, they're frightened of us. When the police stop us, they don't see their sons or daughters. They're frightened. It's not they're not villains. And I recall in the middle of this and just maybe brought it home to me. My youngest is Chilean. We adopted my son from Chile, and now he gets his driver's license. And I said to him, as a prosecutor, former prosecutor, I said, Mark, you're going to get stopped and receive a traffic ticket. He said, Dad, I'll never receive a traffic ticket. I said, trust me, you will receive a traffic ticket. And when the police officer stops you, you are to keep both hands on the steering wheel, particularly if it's at night, and you are to say, Officer, whatever I did, I'm quite sorry. And I said, I would take care of it. If it wasn't wrong, I will handle it. But you say, Officer, I'm sorry. And when he asks for your license, you'll see to say, Officer, my license is in the glove compartment. May I open the glove compartment, or would you prefer to open it? And he says, you open it, you move very, very slowly. And he said, Dad, and I explained to him why. I said, because you look Hispanic. And the officer doesn't see his son when he looks at you. And he said, is that the guidance you gave to my daughter, his sister, our biological child? And I said, no, Mark, I didn't have to. And that, to me, spoke volumes, the duality.
So an incredible journey for yourself personally in realizing, unfortunately, how society still treats people who don't look the same. But I also think the story is one of the dream of why people are in law school, to have an opportunity to really make a difference beyond helping one person at a time, but really affecting policy change and feeling that you can do great. So congratulations, really a job well done and something worth celebrating. That wraps it up for us here on the docket. Scott Fine, thank you for joining us today.